What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
The NBA playoffs are here, and with FanDuel, your group chat's about to be going off. Because right now, new customers can bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. And with live bets, your heart emojis will really be racing from tip-off to the final buzzer. Plus, when you win, you'll get paid faster than your friends can send you a victory gift. Or is it GIF? Who cares? You won! So get the word out to your crew and download FanDuel today. New customers bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Official partner of the NBA.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to the new episode of New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. And I'm your host, Olga Breininger. For each episode, we choose an important book in the field of Russian and Eurasian studies, and we interview its author. Today, we are going to be talking with Douglas Rogers, the author of The Depths of Russia, Oil, Power, and Culture After Socialism, which was published by Cornell University Press in 2015. Douglas Rogers is an associate professor of anthropology at Yale University. His research interests include political and economic anthropology, and particularly the anthropology of natural resources. He has been doing anthropological research in Russia since 1994, collaborated with Moscow State University as well as with Perm State University. And in fact, it is precisely the city of Perm and its post-Soviet history that we are going to be discussing today.
So welcome to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, Douglas, and we are very glad to have you talk today. How are you doing?
I'm just fine. Thank you for having me, Olga.
So traditionally, the first question we usually ask our speakers is about background. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I grew up in New Jersey in the United States and grew up really in the sort of end of the Cold War period. In the late 80s, I was in high school. And that was really my start into Russian language and Russian culture and Russian history. I started taking Russian in high school, actually. It was offered in my high school in the late 1980s. And by the time I was off to college, I went to Middlebury College. I continued. That was a time very different than now when, you know, there were 600 students in the class and 60 of them were in first year Russian. So like 10% of the entering class was interested in Russian language and culture. Things have changed up till the present day. But that's where I started way back then, sort of as the Cold War was ending and Russia was a new and interesting place and a new and interesting language to think about.
So do you think there has been a lot of difference in terms of how to study Russia and approaches to studying Russian and Eurasian region between the Cold War?
I think so. And you know, the kind of trajectory that my own career and interest in Russia has taken, I mean, not only mine, but mine in particular, is sort of diagnostic of that. I mean, I was in the, you know, not first, but, you know, first and a half generation of anthropologists who worked in Russia, where all of a sudden after the end of the Soviet Union, you could do field work. And there were a group of people who did this in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. And then my main field work was sort of in the late, for my dissertation anyway, was in the late 1990s, early 2000s. And that, along with, you know, increasing archival access, was a major change in how people studied studied the former Soviet Union, studied Russia, and it was very exciting back in the 90s to think about doing field work in Russia and to think about the possibilities of actually living in rural Russia, as I did for a long time, and doing interview-based work. That was something, you know, in comparison at least to the Cold War years, when I remember reading my first books about Russia in the late 80s, it was something very different.
I know that you have been doing field work in Russia for over 20 years now, and I was actually interested what brought your attention to Perm rather than Moscow, and why did you decide to focus your book on Perm?
That's right. I mean, I've actually, the first time I was in the Perm region was in 1994, so I was still in college at that point. I was interested in, still back in college, I was planning to do my senior thesis about Russia, and I was interested in religion, and I was taking a lot of anthropology courses, and I had decided I was going to do my senior thesis on old believers. And while I was on this semester abroad at Moscow State in the spring of 1994, I got to know some Russian scholars at Moscow State in the history department who studied old believers, and they invited me on a summer expedition to go study old believers in the Perm region. And I said, great, let's go. So I spent a month traveling around rural areas of the Perm region, visiting old believer communities with some wonderful Russian scholars who are still great friends today. And so that was my first trip to the Perm region in 1994. And that was really the beginning of my first book project, which took me through my dissertation and through my first book, which was an ethnography of a village basically in the Perm region, an old believer village that was also a, you know, a pre-revolutionary peasant town, and then a collective and state farm, and then a sort of post-Soviet struggling agricultural enterprise. And it was a study of ethics and morality over the course of three centuries in this town, as it was informed by religion on the one hand, old belief, and sort of agricultural transformations over the years on the other hand. So that was really the, you know, almost 15 years in one way or another, with some breaks spent thinking about this part of the Perm region. And I sort of stuck with it in the oil book.
Oh, I see. So, well, moving to the discussion of your book now, we know that Perm has for a long time really been an industrial hub. And then in your book, it comes out as, you know, the new cultural center, or almost having the ambition to become the new European cultural capital. So how did this change happen, and what was the role of oil in it?
Right. So I guess your question sort of encompasses the beginning and the end of the book. And that's really the set of transformations I trace from the Perm region being largely an industrial region in the Soviet period, part of this large Urals industrial heartland, to the sort of 2009-2012 period, which is the last part I treat in the book, where all of a sudden, under Governor Andrei Cherkunov, the Perm region's main goal is to become a European cultural capital. So we can talk about the various pieces of how we got from one to the other, but the first thing I would say to begin with your question is that, you know, we don't think of the Perm region much as an oil region. We think of it as an industrial region, and so too do people there in the Soviet period. But it was actually the part of the Soviet Second Baku. This was the home of Soviet oil production in the 50s, 60s, in particular, until all the Siberian discoveries of the 60s and 70s. Oil was first discovered in Perm in 1929 and was a fairly important industry all the way through. But the key point here that I make in the first part of the book, where I'm talking about the Soviet period, is that oil simply did not occupy the same place in socialist and Soviet political economy that it does in capitalist political economies. So oil is central to the Soviet economy. This we know. It's an economy based on tractors and planes and things that you need oil products for. But because of the way that socialism worked, oil did not really become a central industry in terms of prestige in the way that it did in the capitalist West in boom towns or petro states. And the reason for this is that is fairly simple, and that the in the socialist economy, oil money, the kind of money that you could produce by selling oil, never made it back to the production sites. So the Soviet Union may have sold abroad a lot of oil and sold domestically a lot of oil, but you didn't have a capitalist economy where this translates into money and that money reappears back at the site of production or accumulates anywhere in particular that's associated with the oil industry. So you don't have Soviet oil boom towns the way we had recently in the United States in North Dakota. You don't have petro states, at least in the same way you get them in the West, where you get this assertively wealthy oil elite that has a lot of influence over the state. All of the money that went that was accumulated through oil sales, international oil sales, sort of went into the Soviet central budget, and that was important. But you don't see those oil booms at the regional level. So part of what I'm doing in that first part of the book is saying, yes, it's right that this was an industrial region and oil was not a very prestigious commodity. And I want to mark that difference with the oil in the capitalist world, both in the 20th century and after.
Oh, so that's actually a great segue to our next question. And I was wondering if you could, you know, continue and tell us a little bit more about the central argument and the structure of your book. So it covers almost three decades of post-Soviet period. And maybe you could tell us more about the process of co-production of state and energy corporates in the current region.
So the structure of the book comes in three parts, really. And the first talks about the movement from socialist to post-socialist oil. So beginning with that moment that I just talked about, the distinctiveness of the socialist oil complex, and then talks about the 1990s and the ways in which that socialist oil complex was transformed in the whole set of post-Soviet transformations. And then I spend some time on the 2000s, where I talk about the sort of boom years, the rise of regional oil corporations and their connections with the state. And then I talk about this this topic that you mentioned in the last three chapters, the way in which oil was translated in the Perm region, particularly into cultural projects. So that's the overall outline. I mean, to pick up where I left off a little bit with this, the end of the socialist oil complex, of course, all of that I had talked about the sort of declining or the relative lack of prestige of the oil industry in the socialist period begins to change in the 1990s. And I spend a couple chapters talking about how that happened at the regional level. And this seems to me to be a really important part of the story of oil in the post-Soviet period that's not typically told. The sort of standard account that we hear about is this giant battle over control of production fields. It's waged in Moscow and between the Kremlin and oligarchs, and with the sort of role of international oil companies shifting, but on the edges. But I tell a very different story here, and it's about the central role of regional corporations and regional exchange and regional state agencies in shaping the 1990s. And one of the things that appears as I talk about this is that it was really not, to begin with at least, a story of privatization that drove post-socialist changes in the Perm region's oil complex. It was not about who got to privatize which company when. And the reason for that is that even before privatization happened, even before there were vouchers and shares and auctions and all these elements that we're used to hearing about, the circulation of oil products through the region, who got, you know, gasoline from the refinery and how it moved and what it was exchanged for became absolutely central to the functioning of the Perm region on an everyday basis. This is already late 80s, sort of perestroika crisis into the very early 1990s, end of the Soviet Union, massive shortages, inflation, devaluation. All this is felt very deeply because everybody needs oil products in one way or another to drive their products to market or to operate tractors or combines. And as it turned out in the Perm region, those businesses and those individuals and those agencies of the state that were able to move that oil, those oil products, were crucial to the way everybody got along. And this often happened through barter. It happened through demonetized exchange. We trade you oil, oil products at the time of sowing your crops for products at the time of harvest. So the regional state agencies are very big into this particular kind of deal where they provide oil products to privatizing state or collective farms, and then they take the wheat or the grain or the crops and then redistribute it. So in thousands and millions of little transactions, oil becomes quite central to getting by at all in the early 1990s. And the people and small companies and agencies of the state who began to control those chains of, I call it petro-barter, were the seeds of the relationship between the oil company and the state as it grew up in the 2000s. And they are much more central to what actually happened and how events folded than anything that was going on in Moscow and to any sort of privatization deals. As a matter of fact, the main oil company in this region is now Lukoil. But it was not originally. This was not originally part of Lukoil's holdings. And in fact, Lukoil's bid to take over the Perm regional industry was substantially contested and changed and in many ways pushed back and transformed into regional interests by this coalition of businessmen and state functionaries who were specialists in trading oil in a very everyday way. So this is a story in the 1990s about the regional influence of oil as against and even as a more important thing than sort of central stories about Russia and stories about privatization that we're most used to. So that takes us through, I guess, the first major part of the book, which is from, I call it from socialist to post-socialist oil, where eventually, you end up with Lukoil running oil production, refining, distribution in this region. But to a very significant extent, you end up with those interests not subordinate to either Moscow in a state sense or Moscow in a Lukoil sense, but to regional coalitions and to regional oil figures.
That sounds fascinating and really interesting. And what was happening later in the boom years and then with the coming of Chirkunov?
Right. So that sort of takes us up to the late 1990s. 1998 financial crisis and then the coming of power in the presidency of Vladimir Putin and sort of re-centralization to some extent. And at that point, also rising oil prices. So you get the consolidation of an oil industry by the late 1990s, early 2000s. Then oil prices kick in and money starts flowing into the Perm region. So at this point, I'm talking it's less a story of sort of disintegration and a story of reintegration of corporations, of the building of a regional state at the in the Perm region, how state agencies were put together, how they were funded, and the tight relationship to the oil industry that emerged. As suddenly there is money in the budget, there is a push from above, from Putin's Kremlin to end the sort of wild 1990s, have companies reinvest at home to centralize some state control. And so that's really the story of these two chapters, and they come directly out of the story of provisioning oil and the sort of alliances between the oil industry and oil businessmen and state agents in the 1990s. Many of those people are still in the same place in the 2000s as more money is coming in, as there are more demands on the company, as there's to reinvest, and there are increasing demands for state agencies at all levels to sort of take some control and establish a state after the wild 1990s. And so I trace here over the course of the, around 2000 to 2008, the very tight connection between LukeOil as a set of structures in the oil industry in the Perm region, a private industry, and all kinds of state agencies. And the fulcrum for these interactions is what in the Perm region became known as the social and cultural project movement. This was an innovative way of funding the social and cultural sphere by which sort of Russian state bureaucrats and others would call everything from healthcare to cultural production to education, various domains in which the Russian state and other states are sort of active in social life. And these are the kinds of things that citizens look for from the state and that state agents struggle to provide, right? Funding for education, schools, funding for healthcare, funding for, particularly in the post-Soviet context, culture. But the problem is in the early 2000s in the Perm region, there's not much money for this, at least at the grand level that many former Soviet citizens expected. And it is LukeOil Perm and its various affiliates and subsidiaries that begin to provide in the early 2000s, late 1990s, especially early 2000s, in a huge way then by 2004, 2006, funding for social and cultural projects. Often social and cultural projects that are run by the state, by the regional state agency, of education or healthcare or whatever. But the money often comes from LukeOil Perm. And so I chart this very careful relationship, this sort of dance that emerges between the oil company and the regional state around these projects. And some of the effects that come out of this. So, for instance, LukeOil was interested only in funding projects that took place in areas where it had its own operations, which is about half of the districts of the Perm region. So you end up with, by the end of the 2000s, the end of these massive projects funded by the oil company to a significant extent, a big spatial divide in where culture is happening, where the best educational or healthcare or folklore ensemble groups are located. And they're all located in oil producing regions. They're located on top of oil deposits because LukeOil is spending money through the state on these particular regions. And they're doing this for a number of reasons that I talk about. But one of the effects is this sort of striking spatialization of culture in the 2000s, where you start to get very clear differentiation between oil districts and non-oil districts around cultural development or lack thereof. Now, that's sort of what it looks like from the state side. They're in need of and very much wanting to expand state coverage for and support for the social sphere and the cultural sphere, and they look to LukeOil to do this, and they make various compromises. From LukeOil's side, they are themselves very interested in social and cultural projects for a somewhat different reason, although it intersects, and that is that this is a time of massive critique of the oil industry from all sides. Still in the memories of the sort of deprivation of the 1990s are very clear to most people. Most people in the Perm region, particularly in rural areas, are not doing very well, and it's clear that the oil industry is doing very well. And there's massive critique of the inequalities that are resulting, of the oligarchs. And you get similar critiques from above, from the Putin administration and from the Kremlin, saying, oligarchs and big businesses need to invest in their territories. Enough of the sort of hiding the money in Cyprus and Switzerland. So LukeOil responds by LukeOil Perm responds by looking a bit at what Western oil companies and other natural resource companies are doing. And that's engaging in what they call corporate social responsibility. Again, borrowing a term from the West, of investing money in local ecological programs, local cultural, local educational, local healthcare initiatives, as a way of showcasing their concern for and interest in the populations that they're that host them. So they're very interested in, Luke Oil is, in improving its own image of not being quite as beset by critiques from local populations or from local politicians. And what's at stake for Luke Oil is really access to, you know, smooth access, they would say, to oil producing districts. They need roads, they need pipelines, they need land deals, they need all kinds of things in a very local, spatialized way. And a high level of discontent with the company can get in the way of that. So they're very interested in improving their image and doing so in ways that are visible, that have a visible impact on the district and help people make some money or get by in difficult times. And the first project that they picked for doing this was cultural production, sponsoring folklore ensembles, local artisans, things that might allow people in these depressed agricultural struggling regions to make some money by doing things that they might do at home, artisan production and then selling it. And Luke Oil very, very quickly gets into the tourism industry, trying to get people to come to these regions and buy folk crafts and things like this. So this is the sort of from the company perspective, their view of how they're investing in local regions is through corporate social responsibility. And it sort of links up with the state agency's efforts to also provide services for these regions. So you get what I call a very tightly intertwined state corporate field of interactions around oil and social and cultural development, where the company and the state are really become indistinct from each other, in particularly in the oil producing districts of the Perm region, and particularly on this field of culture and cultural production.
So you position Luke Oil's activity, say, within the range of global turn to corporate social responsibility. But also, at some point in your book, you say that Luke Oil, more than any other energy corporation in Russia, has been the successor to the Soviet oil and gas industry practices. So do you think this Soviet heritage or institutional memory may have affected their choice of investing into culture compared to, say, Shell in Nigeria, who prefer to invest into infrastructure?
Yeah. Great question. Right. So this actually, your question nicely captures two things that I'm trying to do in the book. The first one is to say that, as you began, that Luke Oil is part of a global turn towards corporate social responsibility. And part of what I'm wanting to say here is that, you know, the frequent story we hear about Russian oil corporations and Russian capitalism is one of sort of oil and culture going off the rails and crony capitalism, and look how corrupt it is and look how awful it is and this giant mess. But actually, in comparative perspective, I don't see that that the difference between Luke Oil's corporate social responsibility in the Perm region and you know, Chevron's or Shell's elsewhere is so different. They're part of what I think of as sort of a global family of interactions between states and corporations on the field of corporate social responsibility. And I think Russia is actually quite closely tied up with the ways that other corporate social responsibility projects play out elsewhere in the world. So I'm wanting to say that, you know, Russia is not actually so different on this score, and that in many ways the story of capitalism in the last 20 years or so is about the increasing significance of corporations in social and cultural lives. It looks different in different parts of the world, but Russia is not some outlier here. Russia is very much a part of these global trends. And to get to the second part of your question, one of the reasons I think it is because there is what you call this institutional memory or this background expectation from the Soviet period that part of what oil companies, part of what any company does is take care of its people, right? So you always had Soviet company towns where education or healthcare or culture were the domain of the enterprise, whether it was a collective farm interested in cattle or an oil company or a car manufacturer, whatever it was, the companies had a big role in the lives of people. That ebbed a bit in the 1990s during the era of privatization and all these Russian companies sort of getting rid of the social sphere, privatizing. As they privatize, they get rid of the fact that they owned the local club and the museum and, you know, sponsored the healthcare, you know, the hospital or whatever. But that sort of reemerges in the 2000s, where in this era of regional level state formation, where companies are again, particularly in the oil industry in the Perm region, interested in, now it's in the name of corporate social responsibility, but interested in many domains of the lives of their workers and employees and families of their employees and others who live in the territories where they have influence. And I think you see that, or I trace it in particular ways in the people who are involved in these grant competitions and in the ways that social and cultural project funding is distributed. And in a very practical, direct, on the ground, traceable way, it's the same people who were doing this kind of work in the Soviet period. So librarians, museum workers, these are folks who in the 1990s didn't have a lot to do. There wasn't a lot of money for culture. The sort of connection between culture and ideology was sort of weakened in question anyway. But all of a sudden, these same folks who were still, many of them in the same positions, or at least occupying similar places in the state administrations of rural areas of the Perm region, they are the ones writing the grants to Lukoil saying, we have this project that we want to do in education. Help us with this. Or we have a folklore ensemble, or we're going to have this kind of a summer program for kids to educate them about the history of the town. Please fund this. So there is that institutional memory, and it's also a personal memory of former party members, former culture workers, suddenly sort of reinserted into important roles in the 2000s by the sudden availability of money from Lukoil and interest from state agencies in new kinds of programming. So it's a very particular history, as you point out in your question. This is the Soviet past. It's not the same past as you get in Nigeria or Indonesia or other places where corporate social responsibility is going on. But it leads us into what I think is a global family of state corporate connections in the energy culture nexus that I want this book to sort of illuminate from a particular Soviet and socialist past.
That is extremely interesting. Well, if you allow me to return to something we have already briefly mentioned, I wanted to say that something I found particularly fascinating in the depths of Russia is your strong intention to challenge the main narrative of, say, Putin, oil, Soviet past. So how do you think your work conceptually challenges this narrative?
Right. I mean, this is a book about an oil region, and it tells the story of Soviet and post-Soviet oil from the perspective of the Perm region rather than from the perspective of the Soviet Union and Russia. So it's a different unit of analysis, and I think that shift in perspective allows us to tell an entirely different story by taking a much more closer account of how oil actually moves, and how very local, very regional businesses and state agencies all interact with each other to create these larger scale effects and larger scale outcomes. And I think that that ends up with a very taking a regional perspective and tracing the way the oil moves, where it's refined, where the actual cultural project is taking place, is in the oil region or not. Those kinds of questions that I ended up pursuing here, they end up telling a very different story than several of the stories that are most commonly told about oil in Russia and elsewhere. In particular, because, you know, for one thing, I don't focus a lot on money. Typically, accounts of oil, whether they're sort of popular accounts or scholarly accounts, focus less on oil itself than on oil money. So, you know, what share of the Russian budget is oil revenues, or how rich are the richest oligarchs, or what is the income from foreign exports or domestic sales, or what is the oil price? All of those things are about money. But when you start from a regional perspective and you start saying, okay, where is the oil? How does it move? How do these particular qualities of oil as a substance, as a material, move through a region? What are the symbolic associations? What are the ways in which people transact that oil, actually in concrete ways. Who did you trade oil with and how? When? All of those kinds of questions enable me to tell a quite different story than one that just says oil becomes lots of money and deforms the state, or oil expenditures look this way in Russia and a different way elsewhere in the world. So the region level perspective enables me to challenge that oil and money story. And as I've already outlined a little bit, I think it enables me to challenge the story of the Putin era as one of intense and sort of unidirectional centralization. Yes, I think there's more claimed central control in Russia these days than there was in the 1990s. But in all of these periods that I talk about, regional coalitions, regional actors, regional processes are just as important as what's going on at the center. And I think this is, if I had a main lesson that I wanted readers of the book to take away from this about Putin era Russia, even if, you know, even the name Putin era Russia puts Putin at the forefront of everything. And I'm hesitant to do that. I don't think that that's the best way to tell the story. I think there's always these kinds of much more complicated ways of thinking about how the center interacts with regions or other kinds of units. It's not necessarily just a region, not necessarily just a corporation. But there's always more complicated and illuminating stories to tell than the kinds of ones we increasingly see these days that focus so much on the Kremlin or so much or even on the person of Putin or so much on Moscow. I just don't think that that's what's going on most of the time. It's not that that kind of dynamic is irrelevant, but it's never the full story.
I have two more follow-up questions for you on this. So one is on regions, and the second is on oil and money. So maybe let's start with oil and money. What I wanted to ask you is that I thought that something which can be traced in your book is the implicit criticism of social sciences, which very narrowly focus on transformation of oil into money. And you invite for a more full-spectrum approach to the material life of oil. So what do you think are the perspectives of such approach in general, and in particular when it comes to Russian studies?
Right. So once you set aside the oil and money nexus, or at least make it, you know, take it out of the of the main thing, all kinds of other transactions, exchanges, possibilities open up. So I guess I'll just talk about two other kinds of transformations or exchanges. One is one I've already mentioned, which is petro barter, the exchange of oil for goods or services, or other oil products or tractors or whatever, crops, rather than direct exchanges for money. So exchanges that don't go through this sort of universal equivalent of money, but go through other kinds of transactions. And that became actually quite crucial in the Perm region because of the way that not running the exchange through money allowed people to create very potent symbolic connections between oil and the region. So not abstract money, but our oil, oil from our, from beneath the Perm region, refined at our refinery, moved through the region in exchange for everything from apples to timber to crops to consumer goods to sugar. And it enabled people to get by. And the people who were running those exchanges were able to create their reputations and earn a measure of prestige because they were able to say, look, we are enabling everybody from small farmers to mid-sized corporations to the entire regional state administration to get by because we're circulating our oil. And our oil products for the good of everybody. It was that very close material connection between our oil and regional identity that was the beginnings of sort of post-Soviet identity in the Perm region. And it was explicitly in contrast to all the sort of wild money of pyramid schemes and devaluation and circulating dollars and all the confusion about rubles and dollars and everything that was so alienating and uncertainty producing for post-Soviet citizens in the 1990s. That was all there. And on the other hand was our oil, this very material, concrete set of exchanges of petro barter. So there's one thing that you get if you move aside from from just money. And you think about the very concrete ways in which oil moves and what it's exchanged for and the symbolic associations of it. Another thing that you get, and this is a bit later, not in the 1990s, but in the 2000s, is an ability to see the way that oil and culture began to rub up against each other. And the symbolic associations of oil and culture become really central to these social and cultural projects, in which this is part of where I get the title of my book from, The Depths of Russia. Lukoil's sponsorship of historical festivals and folklore ensembles and the sort of recovery of a pre-Soviet identity and ethnic identities, Russian and non-Russian, in the region is really a story about searching for an authentic past, a deep past. And it's not a coincidence, I argue in the book, that this gets sort of very closely tied to the depths of the region in a geological sense, where Lukoil becomes the sponsors. Lukoil, who's a specialist in the geological depths of the region, in this oil and in this drilling and in all this production that's suddenly becoming monetarily and materially central to the region, also becomes the specialist through this sponsorship and through their very close association with sponsorship of historical revival and cultural revival and folklore and archaeology and all of these other kinds of things, which are also about the depths. So I don't think you'd see that if you just focused on the money either, right? So Lukoil gives a grant to this region to fund a historical festival. If you stop at the money, then you're just thinking about a transaction. And, you know, maybe you would do analysis, you know, how much of Lukoil's budget is in corporate social responsibility and how much is it not. But if you set aside the money or see that as only part of what's going on, then you can see the whole symbolic associations of oil as a substance that has particular qualities like its depth beneath the region and other things that can be said to have depths, right? Like culture or history and these associations as they're formed in these festivals and as people begin to inhabit them, become very clear. And I think although Lukoil was not a sponsor of the Oleg Chirkunov's cultural capital campaign, they kept some distance from that. This association between oil and culture was very potent in the 2000s. And I think it was part of the reason that this cultural capital campaign got underway, is that culture was something that the Perm region was beginning to specialize in and thought they could make a name out of. So those are just two of probably several ways in the book in which I say, okay, let's just not say it's all about oil and money. Let's actually trace how these things move and what kinds of associations and transformations grow out of them and how those things are caught up in political and economic and social cultural transformations.
Well, something you emphasize in your book and something which also came up in our conversation is that that you think it is important to focus on regional study processes rather than just doing the study of center and federal level study. So do you think that would be equally true for, say, the study of the Soviet period or Imperial Russia?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think yes is my answer. I mean, I'm a big fan of subnational of studies that take units of analysis below the sort of standard nation state that informs so much scholarship, say in political science or things like that. So I'm a big fan of other units of analysis. They don't have to necessarily be regions. You know, my first book was really about a village, but it wasn't just about the village. It was about how a focus on a particular place and a particular conjuncture and studying that conjuncture in a lot of detail enables us to say things about much bigger processes, including those at the nation state, including those beyond. So, you know, whether it's a village in my first book or a region in the second book, the idea is not that either place is a sort of part for whole representative sample of a bigger thing like Russia or the Soviet Union or, I don't know, the global oil industry, because it's not. It's got its own particularities. It's got its own historical background. There's all sorts of contingencies. But the idea is by focusing on a smaller unit of analysis, you can see in a lot more detail how various large-scale forces configure and influence each other and build on each other in all sorts of interesting contingent ways. And once you trace those contingencies and think about how they work together, you can come up with larger scale theories. You can work back to these larger kinds of theories of how things work that other people can then test elsewhere or try elsewhere. Or you can even, I think, make some larger claims, such as the one I was making about, you know, the ways in which corporate social responsibility in Russia is part of the same family as corporate social responsibility in, you know, Nigeria or Ecuador or Indonesia. And that, I hope, changes some perspectives, doesn't just cut Russia out of the picture there. So I think there's great promise for studies of all sorts of units of analysis. And I would encourage those who think that a regional study or a village study is only about that region or about that village to think again, because precisely the point is that you can get to these larger scale issues through the study of the ways in which they configure at a smaller scale.
Well, as far as I understand, the study of resources has generally privileged the nation state over the local and the regional. So has this made any conceptual difficulties for your research of the Perm region?
Well, yes and no. I mean, for one thing, that's true. That is the privileged space of these studies in the Perm region and elsewhere. But once I started looking, there was actually a great deal of scholarship, particularly Russian scholarship, particularly by regional studies scholars and all kinds of interesting stuff done about the regional level in Perm. So once I started looking for it, I spent an enormous amount of time in libraries looking at, you know, studies by Perm regional scholars and amateur historians and folks who were just terrific on their understanding of the regional history of the oil industry. So there's a lot there. Once I stopped looking in scholarly studies by, you know, big name academics in centers and outside of Russia and things like this. So there's actually quite a lot there once you start looking. But I guess it actually left a pretty big opportunity for me in that this is, you know, there's not a lot of studies of oil in Russia that take this kind of a perspective. And so I think, and, you know, it's now, you know, there's a fairly big anthropology of oil and natural resources these days, and a lot of it does take a regional or a local perspective. So outside of Russia, there's a pretty big scholarship for me to work with and bounce off of. Inside of Russia, not quite so much yet.
So one striking thing about your book was your saying that one of the most consistent observations you have had over your more than 20 years in fieldwork in Russia is the preoccupation of the locals, of the local scholars with the space and the idea of Perm on the map of Russia. So how do you think what has been happening with Perm over the past two decades has really changed the perception of Perm as a city in Russia?
Yeah, that's a good question. And here I'm a little bit, you know, I've spent so much time in the Perm region that I find it a little hard to compare on this score with other Russian regions, particularly on this sort of, I wouldn't call it an obsession, but a very detailed and present interest in maps and space and how space is changing and where does Perm lie on the map of the Urals or on the map of Russia. I would guess that there's something like that going on in lots of different places. But in the Perm region, it's become, you know, particularly with Oleg Chirkunov's cultural capital campaign, it's become, or it not so much now since that, that era is over really. But it's become a particular focus of sort of this effort of region branding, of making a distinctive name for the Perm region in this effort to attract tourism dollars, to attract federal funding. Like, what is the brand of the Perm region, of the city of Perm or of other cities within the Perm region, or even of little you know, every little town, it seemed, had a project to discover its own brand and market that brand. And so I think that's been one of the striking things to watch over the years, is the emergence of all sets of sort of nested claims about the distinctiveness of a particular place and a particular time, and how those things can be worked into development plans for the region or for the city or for a town. The distinctiveness of a particular place and its products, and Luke Oil has been absolutely central to this, not always in the marketing of oil, but in the marketing of other kinds of things as well, cultural products or particular sort of heritage sites or refurbished churches or things like this. So I think that trend towards region branding, perhaps particularly on display in Perm with the sort of European Cultural Capital Project, but I think it's a much wider concern in Russia as regions and localities compete for federal dollars, you know, putting oneself on the map, recognizing oneself, finding ways for the federal center or others, whether they're tourists or bureaucrats or whoever, to recognize you and your place is probably a pretty important thing in a lot of different places.
Well, I think we have already taken a lot of your time, Douglas. So one question, maybe to finish off our show, is about your current work. So what research are you doing now, and what can we be expecting from you in the coming times?
Well, in the short term, I'm working on a few smaller projects that also have to do with some oil and energy things in Russia, some things about oil and the oil industry in visual culture, in documentaries and films and other places, again, in Russia as compared to elsewhere in the world. And probably a few other things in that vein are the more short-term things. I'm also putting together a longer, bigger project that may end up being another book, but I'm not far enough along on that yet that I'm happy talking about it. So that one was going to have to wait for our next interview, I'm afraid.
We would love to wait for it. And, you know, it was really great to have you on the show today. So thank you a lot for this fascinating conversation.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me, Arnold.
So this was my conversation with Professor Douglas Rogers about his book, The Depths of Russia, Oil, Power, and Culture After Socialism. I hope you enjoyed the interview, and please join us soon for more episodes of New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, which will feature Jonathan Platt, Laura Olson-Osterman, Tanya Zaharchenko, and Molly Brunson. Until then, this was your host, Olga Breininger. Take care, and keep listening to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies.